This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. That's audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Well, welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harrell. So glad to be with you once again. You know, over the last few years of doing this program, there have been things that have come more or less in vogue. The last few years, the big hot button in the paranormal community has been this concept of ghosts. And I remember when I was a kid that the big thing was UFOs. Well, we've come full circle, and now we're hearing more and more in the news about UFOs, these sightings in China in particular, and the recent sighting in New York. And it seems more and more UFOs are making themselves known, or at least it's being reported a lot more. That's why I think our guests tonight are very timely. My guests tonight are Nigel Kerner and Dr. Andrew Silverman. And they both have a great deal of interest in this particular area. Nigel has written a book called Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Let's tell you a little bit about the guests before we get started. But the subtitle is The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. Nigel Kerner is an author and freelance journalist who was born in Sri Lanka, his mother from a British planting family, and his father an officer in the British Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm. He really grew up with an interest in human affairs and how these interface with science, religion, and philosophy. And his fascination with UFOs resulted in his first book, The Song of the Grays, published in 1997. And he continues his study. And then we have also Dr. Andrew Silverman. Nigel described him as one of his compadres, longtime compadres. He's a medical doctor. And he has been interested since childhood in the nature of what we are as human beings and what our potential is. And one thing that I know Nigel and Dr. Silverman have discussed at great length and done work on is the idea of the Shroud of Turin and how that ties into all this. So I think it's going to be a fascinating paranormal podcast tonight. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. I can't wait to dive right in.
Well, thank you for inviting us on the show. Let's hope that we can lay this down in some kind of clarity for your listeners, and hope we have an exciting discussion ahead of us.
Well, let me start at the beginning. What got you interested in the idea of UFOs? And you can both kind of describe to us what your fascination in this has been for all these years.
Well, it came actually as a prompt from my son, my second boy, Darren. It was a really surprising question that he turned and asked me one day when he was 12 years old at the time. He's considerably older now, but it started the ball rolling. And his question was, Dad, are UFOs real? Now, this was a long time ago, as I say, nearly, as I recall, 28 years ago, something like that. And I hadn't given much thought to UFOs in terms of a particular definitive subject as such. But of course, I, with everyone else, one heard about things in space, and there was a lot of exploration. People were preparing to go to the moon and all that kind of business. And of course, I'm old enough to know about the first sighting of these things by that American pilot that claimed that he'd seen these saucer-like objects moving across and so on. And all that kind of thing is there. Then you've got the old Buck Rogers business, and you've got all the space comics. I think we we've all come through a kind of indentured life based upon these things and so on. And no one ever really took UFOs to be, you know, something of a particularly interesting phenomenon and so on. But coming from my son, of course, the question was taken more seriously because he's a pretty hitched up fellow up top with where the gray matter's concerned. And I wasn't going to have him come back to me at a later date and have a go and say, look, you talk a load of nonsense about this, because I was determined to do a little bit of research before I gave him my final answer. And you know, that research has actually turned my entire life upside down, because I came at all of this as a real diehard skeptic, and there was no way that I was going to admit that the UFO phenomenon was anything to do with our particular reality here, as we see, feel, touch, whatever, with our sentience, you know, the things of this world and so forth. But we all kind of go our own ways in life and so on. And mine is a science background. And obviously I was rather used to looking at things through a narrow kind of methodology, through the test tube, so to speak, and so on. And I thought I'd give him a fairly good, well-informed answer. And I think we all should do that. All of us who have children owe the new generation as much of the truth and as neutrally arrived at as possible, if you see what I mean, Jim. And that is a big, big thing in my life, you know, to try and tell the children as accurately as possible what things might actually be, as far as we can discover them, of course, in a universe of diminishing returns, with the second law of thermodynamics tearing everything apart as we go into greater states of chaos and randomness with time, so to speak. Big, very, very difficult thing. And of course, that in itself was a very crucial kind of undercurrent in deciding where I was going to go on this UFO question, the second law, I mean, of thermodynamics, and looked at the whole thing, cosmology. And the whole thing then became a kind of garden with so many features in it, trees and bushes and thorns and pathways and so forth. Sure. I hope the analogy isn't too obsequious, but I mean, the point is that that's the kind of way one arrived at the conclusion, that when one looked at a single spot, one found that it was surrounded by so many other attendant things, and you had to connect up the dots as you went along and so forth. And the great and wonderful thing about this whole business was that as the further I looked into the UFO phenomenon per se, as such, so to speak, the more I actually was looking into an existential base that most of us take for granted rather loosely, but I, to my astonishment, in fact, stunned me into realizing, my goodness, this thing is not just real, it's the center of all our gravities and our gravitas, so to speak, you know.
Sure. Dr. Silverman, what has been your relation to the phenomena of UFOs?
Well, you see, I've always wanted to try to extend my understanding and knowledge further. And obviously, if you want to do that, you have to look at what is unknown, or rather than just looking at the easy questions. And I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that with all the reports that there have been, that these things are real, and there's so much evidence looking at it from the scientific theoretical point of view that there would be life on other planets. For me, the most fascinating thing is how this all relates to humanity itself, and what humanity is and what humanity is capable of, and that's where my interest that I'll be discussing later about the Turin Shroud comes in.
The coincident parts of this entire business, rather like the quantum field theory, is a holistic thing. And obviously, as we looked at one particular part in it, you began to see where the roots lay of connection between one part and another. And as you connected up the dots, and we looked at this thing in real terms of real strict research terms, and all in all, and it's not just Darren's question that prompted, I've always been fascinated by this. In my own terms, you know, Jim, I've been a person outside the box, I say I'm kind of soaked in the juice of science. But let me tell you that it's never been the normal, you know, wind in the Mr. Mole type of, you know, pebble glasses, narrow perspective of science. I've always tried to look outside the box from all different angles and so on. Rather similar, I'm sure, to your own invective in these things. And then you begin, and if you can do that, and that's the difficulty with science, is that it demands a strict empirical methodological stance. Yes. You really can't get anywhere like that. You get in a narrow alleyway, and that's where you stay mostly, you know. And you have to look in all different directions. And when you do that, see the sky, including the perspective of the grass and the fence that you are fenced up in and so forth, you begin to see an absolutely wonderful a revelation appear before you. And that really is the whole sense of compunction with which I have followed this entire thing, really.
Now, when you look at the phenomena of UFOs, excuse me, there's almost been a, what's the word I'm looking for? There's almost been a fairy tale aspect to it, that the aliens are coming to save us, that they're good guys, so to speak, that they're the white hats, that they're coming to bring enlightenment and so forth. We can talk a little bit later about how you may feel about that, but why do you think that is? Why have we put such a positive spin in general, particularly those of us who are interested, that the aliens are going to come and bring a brighter day for humanity? Why do people tend to think that?
We're all looking for redeemers. Life on Earth is an extremely hard grind for most people. We always need to have sponsors. If you look at our own condition as human beings, we are helpless individuals for a long, long time, all the time being sponsored by the fair views and goodwill of our parents and so forth. We're vulnerable and so forth. So we're always being preferred on, so to speak. We're always being given things. We're always expecting things as a result of that, whilst our brains are growing fastest from, you know, the age from birth to 7 or 6 or whatever. The Jesuits have the Christian Jesuits have this statement, a famous statement, as we all know, that says, "Give me the child at 7 and I'll give you the man," kind of thing. Right. That's because of our brain cells growing fastest at that kind of age, and impressions created up to that time are very strongly set within our psychology and motivate lots of things naturally later on in life. So we are given all of these things, and we want to look at something out there that's always going to be there for us to look at, look after us, and so on. The problem with that is as we grow up and grow older, we get independent, and whilst we get independent, that means we've got to look after ourselves a little bit more, and things become much, much harsher, and competition becomes much sharper, and so on in our lives, and we naturally continue on in this kind of way in fighting a good fight, so to speak. We don't want to see things as unpleasant. We still hanker for, you know, the nice, comfortable and cosseting we get from parents and our mentors and so on whilst we were young and children. So you see, this whole psycho-etiology is built into every single human being in life. And in some parts of the world, culturally, it's more pervasive than other parts of the world and so forth and so on. And I think that expectation built into all of us is why we expect good things to come from unknown things. But of course, I have found that it's quite the opposite where these gray aliens are concerned.
And we'll be right back to this most fascinating paranormal podcast right after this. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. Now, one audiobook to consider is John Grisham's Skipping Christmas. So, for a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. That's to audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. As you know, there are two things that I love. I love Christmas. I've said that on the show before. And I also love Audible. But actually, this kind of brings the two together, Skipping Christmas by the great John Grisham. And basically, the concept, you've probably heard of it before, is that Luther and Nora Crank have decided that they're opting out of Christmas. And this is the hilarious tale of the implications. And it's kind of a social commentary on what the holiday has become in all of its glory, but also sometimes in its over-commercialization and so forth. So check it out. I highly recommend it, as I do Audible. You know, the other day, a cool thing about Audible is that if you have an iPhone, for example, they have a great app, or in my case, an iPod Touch, and it tracks how many hours you listen, and you get different badges for listening at lunchtime or listening on the weekend or listening for so many hours. They really make it fun. And the thing is that the difficulty I have is I love Audible so much that I find it difficult to find a time to listen to the podcasts I want to listen to. So please keep listening to our podcasts. But if you haven't, add Audible into the mix, because they do such a great job. It is a fantastic Christmas option for yourself or for somebody else. So check it all out at audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible.
You're listening to the number one rated program in the Herald household. It's the Paranormal Podcast.
Let's talk about this piece, because this has always fascinated me. Nick Redfern wrote a foreword or a blurb at the front of your book, you know, saying what an interesting theory it is. And I've interviewed Nick in the past specifically on his book, Contactees. And he talked about the phenomena where not abductees, but contactees would report different archetypes of what the visitors look like. We started, you know, with George Demjak in the 50s, where it was blonde haired and blue eyed, and we kind of go to this gray alien. And it struck me that probably, you know, one contributing factor in some of the cases is the popular culture, in that we see what we expect to see. Can you comment about the impact of popular culture, movies, TV, books, on how we perceive the quote aliens?
Well, that's a very powerful source of the kind of psychological drenching we get through our lives. And of course, it's getting more and more pervasive with the popularity of television and films and so on. I think Andrew wants to come in here.
Yeah, I was just going to say, of course, it could work in the reverse way, that if a lot of people have seen these creatures or machines or whatever they are, then that's how it gets into the popular culture in the first place, that's what they look like.
Yes. And so the point is that whilst we get all of this as a kind of, you know, blotting paper, absorbing this stuff constantly, it's extremely difficult for individuals to have a clear, defined pathway in terms of future intention, where they're going, what they mean. Of course, the great questions: who are we? Why are we here? What is the universe? Why is it there anyway? How is it so incredibly kind of, you know, arranged so that tiny physical law, demarcations in physical laws, tiny deviations from it would not have made this all exist? What is this incredible coincidence that puts it all so beautifully together, it seems? And at the same time, you have this contradictory business of the second law of thermodynamics taking the whole thing in a single direction into bits and pieces with time. After all, we all die. Everything rots. It's all one way. And I began by asking the question before I went into the UFO thing as such, is how does that existential base stand up in terms of modern science, physics, and so forth? And of course, it took a lot of study and research over the years to put the whole thing together. And when you look at the whole universe in that sense, in my take of things, I found that the old spiel that we were sold, you know, and I mean, I have to tell you this, I'm a Christian by accident, really, basically, most of us are. Somebody sprinkles some water on us when we are babies and tell us we're Christians, and then we're supposed to live up to this and endorse it a few years later by kissing some bishop's ring and such archaic nonsense, and off we go against its logic and reason, accepting the will and the compunction of our so-called teachers that we find, if you look at the research very carefully, have been lying to us century after century in order to make enclaves and tribes of their own. And so goes all religion. Now, that might be a very cynical view, but I tell you what, I would argue that that holds its place in any argument against against that. And of course, Dr. Silverman is Jewish. I am ostensibly, I suppose, of a Christian background, although I'm not religious, and that's the best stance to look at all these questions from, is to put away all these tribal epithets and so on, and look directly, if you possibly can, with a neutral, objective stance at the empirical evidence, and then look at what is coming from things outside that format, so to speak, you know, thinking, feeling, understanding, all that kind of thing, the soft options software, and I think the more profound and place that real truth lies is in that point of inception that gives us this kind of, you know, capacity. And to me, that was the answer in the end. And it's taken three books to actually explain, you know, in my terms, that it really is from within that kind of sphere of activity, what we call that spiritual sense that can't be kind of empirically enforced or propagated, that true meaning comes. And that's how finally this entire investigation, you know, Jim, had the most amazing surprise for me, because looking at it with such a strong penchant on science, I found myself dumping myself back into this religious perspective, not in terms of tribal organized religion, but in terms of the ethics and the teachings of some great beings that came in the past. And of course, the one that I kind of centered most on, or I was most familiar with, was, of course, Yeshua ben Yosef, the person we commonly call Jesus Christ. And that is how I make this bizarre connection. It might seem bizarre on the face of it, but it's a bizarre connection, it seems, between the Shroud of Turin, the UFO phenomenon, and the entire existential outlay. When you put all those ingredients together, as I've tried to do in my book, Grey Aliens and the Harvest of Souls, it explains that enigmatic title. Incidentally, it wasn't chosen by me. I'll let you into a secret. It was done by the publishers.
Sure.
Much against my chagrin, but then again, you know, they have their own motivations and so on. Anyway, the point was that in the end of it all, the whole thing triumphantly rests on a piece of cloth. That's the incredible surprise that I have had. That's just stunned me. I'm still shaking from it, and it's turned all my values upside down, so to speak. Incredible piece of cloth called the Shroud of Turin, and that's the story that I have tried to say in three books, really, is basically that. How do you connect up this fantastic achievement that you see on this piece of cloth, and how is that related to these gray aliens and technology and all this kind of super duper stuff coming out of space time and so forth, you know?
Well, it is a fascinating topic. We are having a fascinating conversation tonight on the subject of gray aliens and the harvesting of souls. And I must say that you've really kind of set this out where I am very, very interested to see what the next step in all of this is. Our guests are Dr. Andrew Silverman and Nigel Kerner, and we are really enjoying our discussion about this book, Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Now, let's get to this. You're investigating, Nigel, this phenomenon of aliens. When in your investigation do you start to say, wait a minute, this is not innocuous, this is not benign, this in fact may be sinister? I guess the first question, when did you come to the realization that the aliens were real? And then beyond that, when did you come to the point where you said, aha, they're not here to do well for us. They're here to do something else.
Absolutely. You put your finger on it there, if I may say so, Jim. The important thing to realize when you were looking at these various elements in the story is is to ask the question, here is something that is here, testified to by the most amazing observational stances. By that I mean very clever people like astronauts, pilots, and whatever, that have affirmed in thousands of anecdotal and I hasten to say, sometimes physical evidence too, which is not actually shown to us, because I believe there is a huge background situation that tries to keep this from us, and that'll be, I'll talk about that a little later on. But here is something that is apparently and apparently so in our reality terms. There is no ghost-like thing that appears from other dimensions and so on. These things have been seen by Gordon Cooper, and they have been actually verified by Gordon Cooper in his own stance as an astronaut and a pilot. These astronauts are chosen for their power of observation and their stability of mind and so forth. You've got the other chap too,
Edgar Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell, and other astronauts who actually make these statements in private, but don't come up and affirm them in public, and so forth. Not just them. You've got police witnesses. You've got pilots, and over 9,000 reports at the latest count of officially reported UFOs that make pilots wonder about the psychology, the mechanisms that these things seem to show, the craft or whatever they see. And of course, you had that incredible recent news conference at the press club in Washington.
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with that, of
yes.
course. And seven distinguished military people announcing their definite affirmation of UFO activity and so on, and some over nuclear bases that kind of, seem to be able to control our own capacity either to cause war or to actually not do that or whatever. Now, what could these things be that are here and are hiding and are doing the most unspeakable experiments on individuals that seem to have a correlation between each experience in terms of these abductions? Of course, I'm talking about abductions and those kinds of things. And of course, the only thing that keeps what they do away from the people they're doing it to, so to speak, is the fact that they in some kind of way are controlled by mind. And of course, they slip the leash when you are in some kind of hypnotic state. And then the most unspeakable manifestations are explained in these abduction stories under hypnosis and so on. Now, why are these things doing it to humanity if they're beneficent, and doing it in such a cruel and almost, cold-hearted way? Well, number one, I established, it's taken me three books to do this. You'll forgive me if I don't go into the full spiel.
Of course.
But I've tried to be as clear as I possibly can. I mean, these things actually have a physical control in over our being, our person, and so forth. And in having that physical control, they make sure that whatever they do to us is in their interests and not ours. Now, why is that so? If they're here past the speed of light mechanism that Einstein gave us with his relativistic theory formulas and so on, if this intelligence is so great that it can do all of that and bring themselves into our kind of custody on this earth, so to speak, and they can hide from us in such a all-pervasive way, even though sometimes for some reason they are manifested and so forth. If they can keep this kind of canard going for so long in terms of hiding themselves and so on, I, for one, have to be suspicious that their intentions aren't in terms of the benefit of humanity, but is solely in terms of the benefit of themselves. For instance, it's very similar to us looking after animals for experimentation. We really look after them. We make sure that they don't know that the chap in a white coat's going to come and stick needles and do all kinds of terrible things to them and so on and
right.
so forth.
Right.
And we seem to be like lab rats that are being used by a kind of, superior intelligence for their own purposes. Now, within that frame of reference, one has to say that these things are far more likely to be bad, shall we say, to use the horrible word, than good, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Right, exactly. Where do you think they come from?
Well, actually, in a sense, I've never really thought about this because it doesn't matter. The fact is that we've found so many planets now, recent cosmological terms, and they say they think in our own galaxy there may be 100,000 Earth-like planets. It actually gets rid of this, you know, control anthropomorphic God principle, because I'll tell you, if we humans think that God is an old man with a flowing beard on the Sistine Chapel roof with Adam's finger touching him, can you imagine all these other creatures out there in these 100,000 planets that might have developed into our terms of reference in technology, shall we say? They'll have their own version of it, won't they? So obviously there's going to be millions of controlling gods all over the place. So I had to then find some kind of singularity principle that was secular and not anthropomorphic and tribal and all that kind of business, because I think that has to be a load of nonsense now, really, basically, in terms of what we discover with space-time and so on and what's out there. So, you see, in the end, where they come from doesn't really matter. It really, the thing that really matters is that such a principle as roboidic interceptions from an external source exists, and that we have to look at this as a human species extremely carefully. I think Dr.
Wanted to return briefly to the previous question and what Nigel was saying about the abduction phenomenon and evidence from hypnosis, because some people may be under the impression that, oh yes, but this could be suggestion and so on. But interestingly, yes, there was an eminent professor of psychiatry, John Mack at Harvard University, who I was briefly in correspondence with, actually. And he started off from a skeptical point of view, wanting to see how you could account for the abduction phenomenon in so-called psychopathological terms. In other words, what caused this delusion that people... And he looked at all the reports and he actually interviewed these abductees, and he came to the conclusion, against all of what he had believed to start with, that actually they were describing something that had actually happened, that this was an actual physical event that had happened to them, and not it was a memory rather than a delusion or a hallucination.
Right. Yep. That's an excellent point, because I was actually going to bring that up, is that many times skeptics say hypnotic regression is essentially false memory. And I think that's an excellent point to bring up. Yeah. Something that's always fascinated me about this phenomena has been this. When you look back, and particularly his work, familiar with it, going back to the 1970s, is Eric von Däniken, Chariot of the Gods, the sense that there were ancient astronauts, and that these UFOs are not just a phenomena that started in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold, as you referenced earlier, but something that's gone way back in religion. So what's your perspective on that? How long have they been visiting us?
Well, I mean, there are petroglyphs 40,000 years old, made by Australian Aborigines in cave drawings. Some of these things are 60,000 years old, they say. The problem is, you see, mainstream-type scientists are reluctant to interpret these things such as that. But they have to do with that ancient racial memory that's in all of us. And that's the really crucial thing. Wherever these things come from, you see, Jim, it's irrelevant, because what they're dealing with is what we should be looking at. Who are they dealing with, and why are they dealing with these entities? And they're dealing with us, Homo sapiens sapiens. And wherever the threat comes from out there, it's just decoration, really. The fact is that we have, I believe, a profound threat to humanity in this experience, and somebody is hiding these things, and they are helping that somebody hide these.
Well, that was, and then this may get to the crux of the point, because that was my next question.
Yes.
Even before you mentioned it.
Yeah.
You say that you believe that, I don't want to misstate, but I think you said that you believe that there are many people in places, or there are people in places of authority that are covering this up, are very well aware of it, and there's plenty of physical proof to back all of this up, but they're just hiding it. First of all, I guess the question is, who are they, and why are they doing it?
Well, you know, if I knew specifically who they were, and I wanted to say that to you, it will be extremely difficult for me to prove it anyway, because they will be powerful enough to actually obscure anything I say to you.
And I have a feeling our internet connection would go down suddenly as well.
Let me tell you, you're talking about some pretty heavy honchos, and maybe honchos that aren't quite like us either. But then that, again, is a speculation, but it's a derived speculation that I think is worth making. The press club, why isn't this in world news, for instance? Why isn't that particular, happening all over the papers of the world and so forth? It's such an amazing thing. They put, when our royal family has a toothache, it's the front page news. It's absolutely bizarre. There's some, you have to forgive people for coming to the conclusion that something very strange is going on here, because they speculate against the most specious things, and yet something that could be as powerful and as important to that to us all is actually, left out of any kind of consideration in terms of mainstream attention and so forth. But you asked me about the origins of these things and so on. We seem to be steadily, moving towards the transformation of our natural humanity into an artificial one. The progress we're making towards this is something I wrote in an article, for instance, called SIM Card Man. And this is the implementation of the implantation of chips in the human body is gaining acceptance, and be it for, enhancement of intelligence or memory, or as a type of medical alert bracelet, whatever. Of course, there's always a good reason for it. But here we go on and on and on. Now, there's so much evidence now coming out of the recent research in science that this is going to be the norm. We are going to be encouraged to flourish with these artificial implants and so forth. And in the news today, for instance, there are reports that NASA and General Motors are just putting the kind of finishing touches on a project to send robots out into space with astronauts, and that these robots go in three different distinct dominions of function: robots alone, robots with astronauts, and robots taking the place of astronauts, so to speak, in doing their function and so forth. And could the gray aliens themselves be the final product of a civilization at another location in the universe, achieving a similar stage or a superior stage, in this case, in the case of these things here in on the Earth at the moment, in a superior stage of technological advancement, and then carry it on so far that the natural body, our natural bodies, are transformed through artificial implants into biomechanical artificial entities, shall we say. And to my mind, all the evidence suggests that they are an artificial paradigm of existence, these greys, and maybe they are bringing us genetically and through our DNA, through many, many millennia of development and so on, into a kind of format where they can then merge their own psychologies into us. Now, the fascinating question is, why are they doing it? What have we got? Us, a inferior intelligence, that they, a superior intelligence, need, want, and in fact are dealing with at the moment, and so on. That's the big question. Andrew wants to come in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the most fundamental thing for us to try and learn about and discover more about is, what are we as human beings? I mean, the thing is that the empirical worldview that is very popular in science, of looking at the world as just a purely objective thing and forgetting that we're there to view it, it's very limited, really. And even Erwin Schrödinger pointed this out.
Oh,
now,
yes, sure,
the problem is, yeah, where we have to try and ask the questions. Surely that's fundamental. If we're there to do experiments or to observe, where does the mind come from? What is awareness? What is choice? Now, the thing is that if you start off with the idea that human beings and their minds are just only information, like a computer has information, then it's only a few steps from that in the development of technology until you say, why do you actually need human beings at all? Why not, as Arthur Clarke famously had this idea that in the future that the human race would survive by downloading or uploading our mind, so to speak, which he thought was just software, onto a machine that you could then send out into space. and then we would continue. But is there more to us than that? I believe there is, and I believe there's plenty of evidence that there is.
Yes.
And from, as Descartes said, from the fact that we are even here to think, to consider these questions, and that's something that I'd be expanding.
Absolutely.
A bit
later.
One thing that I would point out, it's very interesting because you stated something about the idea of the combination of man and machine, and this is not something that's in fringe science these days. For example, I think of Ray Kurzweil, who's written the book The Singularity Is Near, and his concept is, he's a futurist, is that he's confident that he can achieve immortality if he can stay living long enough. So we do have this mix of man and machine where your mind can be downloaded.
Well,
it's a movement that many people have signed up to, rich people. They want to achieve immortality.
Well, that's a physical immortality. But the incredible thing of all, the whole thing that casts this adrift completely, is that we might have a natural immortality that is nothing to do with a purely physical world. Our universe is going to end. It's going to end in a cold death. It's not immortal in that sense, so to speak. It is going to end. That is what cosmology says now. And it's finite. It's the end of it all. But there may well be a mechanism that this simple, spindly thing we call a human being has that can go on past all of that on an eternal scale. And what then is it about us that we cannot be successfully cloned and mixed with their species prospectus? What is it that they're trying and having such difficulty to do? There is something about us that they consider to be absolutely incredible, that they want. And I believe this is where you get into the spiritual life, death, back again in reincarnation, into life again, mechanism that speaks of our power, our incredible thing. And that's because we come in with the universe, with the origin of the universe, we come straight through down in a derivational line. These things we make and manufacture within the universe, like these cyborgs, like these things, are actually created within the universe, out of the materiality. It's a short-term immortality, if you like, when you look at it in the grand scale terms.
Right.
We have a natural power that is so wondrous that it goes on in an eternal scale. And I think that is what the great teachers were alluding to when they came here, that there is something going to try and compromise that. No matter how much people, would love this idea of continuing on with all these implants and all the rest of it, that what these things are trying to do to us, to give us that type of immortality, is to curtail our power. And this is where soul and all of that kind of religious invective comes in, something I was reluctant to look at, by the way. I had to put my prejudices away, and I really have a look at this, and I found it in a piece of cloth that I call the Shroud of Turin.
Well, then I think, Dr. Silverman, you had something you wanted to add.
Yeah, I think actually human beings know somewhere inside them that a human being is not just information. Why do we not consider it a crime of murder when we unplug a computer? It's got information in it. How could it possibly be that you could download some information and then make something that's aware and that has feelings and so on? Now, interestingly, the quantum theory does come into this. I won't go into too much technical detail here, but it's been shown that you need an observer to be able to make the atom, the electron, whatever it is, real. And Schrödinger, who made the famous equation, who came up with the famous equation of quantum theory that's been shown to be accurate to, billions upon billions of percent, he actually made a point about this, that if we're making reality real, this whole concept of there being a now, a moment that we call now, is itself the product of consciousness. Now, the point about that is, as he said himself, if time happens because of the mind, how can the mind end or begin in time? How can something that we have made then unmake us. And his point was that it can't. Logically, it can't. If we have mind, if we're aware, if we're sentient beings, we must be eternal. Now, if we're eternal and we were born, then we must have been there before we were born. If we're eternal and we die, we must continue after we die. In fact, we don't begin with universes, we don't end with universes, and you can't artificially make that.
Yeah, and of course, this is a crucial thing. I don't think we are seeing the real property and power of our humanity. I think we take it for granted just being human. And doing that brings about the terrible things we do to one another. And it requires a reminder. And I think the great teachers came to point this out. And this particularly is relevant. And I don't want to get religious here. Let me tell you, I really don't want to get religious. But the only individual that has left an idea of what this might be in terms of empirical science and all the rest of it is this individual who brought about this manifestation that they call the Shroud of Turin. Now, Andrew and I were at a conference in Italy in Frascati, actually arguing with the world's top scientists doing research on the Shroud about this particular thing, a seminar. And Andrew delivered a psychological speech somewhat based upon something I'd written some years ago. And he brought this point he was making earlier about the identity of being incepting time, and that reality is a product of an observational stance and so forth, and looking at the logical matrix that actually affords, so to speak. Now, my point is simply this. If we have this wondrous capacity to exist beyond through a mechanism that we call death, and then life again, I think that in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, an individual demonstrated this beyond any shadow of a doubt. And the funny thing is, for all the ones who disbelieve this, 2,000 years later, with the science that we have, we are beginning to understand the full mechanism in its glorious revelation. And that is the thing that kind of made me look at a more spiritual, religious stance as the backing we have, that the Greys actually want. That's why they're here. Our soul fields. And I call that a morphogenic electrospatial field. That's just simply the information line that ties each of our ancestries to the present time from the beginning of the universe. And that is the most important thing. If they can get into that information line, then they have, if you like, an eternity. And if they can actually work it through our DNA, because they see us die, and maybe their technology can see what survives our death into some other expression of going on, then they would say, hey, come on now, this is surely worthwhile. Incidentally, I want to make a point about space travel and so on later on, but just to keep it relevant to that kind of, you know, window at the moment, it's important to say that we have a facility that no amount of artificial intelligence in a programmed roboid that is made to move through space-time and land on various planets for whatever reasons they want, that the facility that we have is far in advance of that. And I do believe that this is what these highly intelligent mechanisms have noticed about this so-called primitive species. We can live, we can die, and we can come back again. And that little trick is what they want for themselves.
Well, that's a fascinating theory, and I want to get more to it and tie it back into the Shroud. There's more to come right after this break on the Paranormal Podcast. Well, everyone, you know it is the most wonderful time of the year, and that means that it's time to do some shopping. And the place where I do much of my shopping is Amazon.com, and I would encourage you to do the same. But first, I would suggest that you go to JimHerald.com and shop via our links and our search box there at the site. The benefit to me is that we get a small commission on each purchase you make. The benefit to you is it doesn't cost you a penny more. You still get the same great merchandise, many times free shipping, the same great selection, but you also help the show in the process. So it's truly that overused phrase, a win-win. You know, today I went out with my eldest daughter to pick up a gift for my youngest. And my daughter was doing the shopping, so she was very determined to find what she was looking for and wanted to go out and do it for kind of the ritual of it. And sure enough, they didn't have what we needed. We came back home. They had what we needed at Amazon.com. We purchased it and saved some money in the process. So it's a great place, and I do stand by it. So please, when you're doing your holiday shopping, remember old Jim. I'm actually going to use this to help underwrite some new equipment, some new PC equipment in first quarter of next year so I can put out even more shows. So please help us out. Now back to the show. But here's the question for you. This has long been a debate. What separates man from common variety animals, from every other species? And many people, the straight scientists and very, very kind of almost skeptical or just give me the facts kind of person would say, we're an animal. We're just a little bit smarter animal. Yeah. But we're an animal. There's absolutely no difference. So you're saying, A, that we definitely have souls. And then secondly, are we the only species anywhere with souls?
Would say there's less of a difference between us and animals than there is between us and machines. It's a difference of extent, whether you want to use the word soul or not. That the point about life is that scientists have tried, they can't actually create life. Something living has to come from something living. You can't actually artificially put some chemicals together and make it live.
Put lightning on it or whatever. This is nonsense. Consciousness and livingness comes as an inception from when the actual point gave rise to the universe itself, from the singularity that it came from right at the beginning of the universe and so forth. And so I think that is the wonder of us all. And I think the most important thing is that we all, as human beings, realize the preciousness of that particular capacity and feature. That is really the great thing. And I believe something happened, you know. I mean, I'll just take this on a little bit before Andrew just looks at the shroud and what we discovered about this particular thing, proving this incredible capacity in a sense that we all have, right? In my researches, I looked at all the texts in the Bible, the text outside the normal, you know, choreograph canon, if you like, of Christianity with Old Testament, New Testament, all the rest of it. I looked at the things that the people threw out and never let us actually take a good look at, if you see what I mean. The Nag Hammadi library, things like that, the Pistis Sophia, whatever. And I wanted to know, what did other people consider this whole experience was all about and so forth? And there are numerous accounts within many texts in the Coptic Gnostic Gospel Library, for instance, in which this man, Yeshua ben Yosef, carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced with them. Most notable of these explanations is that given in the first Apocalypse of James, for instance, in the Nag Hammadi Codex, you know. Jesus warns James, you know, I think, that the entities are about to take away souls by theft. He then tells him, it seems, that the way to deal with such entities is to be as alike as possible to the state of pre-existence, i.e. the state before existence in the physical universe happened. So it seems he was saying that we come from this derivation. In fact, there are many elucidations in the actual New Testament where Jesus actually says, "Don't ye know ye are gods?" This amazing thing that somehow through devolution, not evolution, to the devolution process from the start, we have reduced ourselves into a situation where we are now what we see, a physical being, just like an animal. And I think all other species are derivations further down the line, so to speak. But all, to answer your question, I believe have a electrospatial field. The only difference is that each species puts a quantum of restriction by not opening the mind to all the information possible. Call it prejudice, call it biases, whatever. An open, free mind to all information, I believe, does actually free and open the spirit out to a re-manifestation in the Godverse. So in doing that, we enhance our level, if you like, of eternal capacity to live, if you see what I'm trying to say. And so each species has a quantum mechanism that defines its own speciesness according to its restriction. If you look at a sparrow or a squirrel, they all seem to be in a kind of fear of their lives all the time. If you look at them, they're always nervous, looking around, whatever. And they live in this constant state of restriction. Human beings are a little less likely to do that, but our world seems to be making us more and more like it. And we have to be looking over our shoulder at so many things these days that we might actually end up lowering our capacity of expression, so to speak, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yes, yes. And then, Dr. Silverman, I think that now is the time we should get to the question Indeed. Of how the shroud ties all of this together, because to me, that is one of the most novel parts of this whole concept, is the idea that that may be in some way the key to all of this.
Yeah. First of all, I'll just say a very brief introduction about the shroud. The first thing to say is I have to mention the words carbon dating, because a lot of listeners will be thinking, oh, yeah, but that's a medieval fake, isn't it? Well, no, it's not. I can back that up. It's been found by some wonderful research that was done by Benford and Marino that actually it's a reweave, that there were, the part that was carbon dated is a mixture of an original first century cloth with another cloth that was put in much later by nuns when they sewed in to repair a fragment that was damaged. And this has been proven. There was a scientist who was very skeptical about this, but he looked into it and he found it's actually true. And this has been published in many peer-reviewed journals. Now, the question is, what is the image on the shroud? How did it get there? Who was the man who did that? What was it about him that meant he could do that? And does that imply that there's something that is actually not just about him, but about all of us as human beings? Now, the shroud is actually the image on there is a photographic negative imprint only on the surface fibers of the cloth. Okay, it's not painted on, and it's got distance coded information. And it's the only evidence that we can explain as scientists about how the image could have got onto the cloth is that there must have been a short, intense burst of radiant energy from the dead body of the man that the shroud wrapped. And now, I should say that forensic pathologists have looked at the imprint and what it tells us about the body, and they've found out that this was a man who had been tortured and crucified and whipped with the Roman flagrum, which is a whip that they had in those days. All the imprints are there, and he had a sharp, thorny cap placed on his head, and so on. And after dying, there are two kinds of things that you can see on the cloth. One is the actual blood marks, and then there's the image marks. And interestingly, underneath the blood, there is no image. So what's happened is that first the blood went on there, when the cloth wrapped him, and then something happened after he had died that he actually shone brighter than the sun. How is that possible? Again, I have to come back to what is the nature of humanity, and it ties into what the nature of matter is as well. Because this was something that Nigel did write about many years ago, that you can logically surmise that if there is such a thing as a human being that has awareness and will, that there's a mind interacting with matter, it makes sense to consider that it's actually a continuum, that matter is, rather than mind being a product of a certain arrangement of matter, matter is, and this is very consistent with quantum theory, matter is a product of the mind. The way he described it was that the atom is frozen thought, okay? And now, this would fit with the connection between mind and matter and how it works. Now, if we are eternal beings, as Schrödinger's evidence that I was pointing to suggested, and actually the other thing that he suggested is that our identity as singular, separate individuals is a temporary, artificial phenomenon, that actually at the basic mind, which is actually aware, is the same in everything, but it's just we have different awareness, different memories, and we have different choices as individuals. But if we all began at a point, or we all can trace our existence back to a point before separation happened, because you don't have separation before you have space and time and matter, then fundamentally we must all be one. And now people like Yeshua or Jesus were always pointing to this fact when they said, for example, love thy neighbor as thyself, that actually our neighbor is ourself, that we're all one. But as Nigel pointed out, the second law of thermodynamics in a physical universe always takes things in the opposite direction. It always divides. It always separates. But we have something, if we have minds, if we have choices, that we can actually decide to go against that. And if we do, and if matter has happened as a result of the choice to separate, which actually perhaps was what caused the Big Bang in the first place, then maybe we can undo that. And if matter is frozen thought, maybe we can unfreeze it. And light, you can show by, if you, there's no time to go into the scientific details of it, but if you look at Einstein's equations themselves, you can see that light has interesting properties, that if you had a being who was light rather than material, okay, then you then become outside of time, because you're wherever you're going instantly all at once. So perhaps this is what was happening, that he had lived a life that was actually putting into practice this ethic of loving your neighbor as yourself to such an extent that he was actually able to change the fundamental nature of his atomic being.
And the crucial thing is this, is in the drift, in the direction in which you apply what we call compunction will in the mind. It seems that the power of the mind to add things together, to bring things together in harmony, we might call that love, you know.
Yeah.
That is a very simple thing to say. And that's why these people, these great teachers, whatever they come from, be it the teacher of Islam, do not believe what the mullahs and all these creatures that came after the great prophet of Islam, Muhammad, said. He too said that. I'm not in any way kind of Islamic, as you know, I have a Christian background. Then you've got Yeshua, then you've got the Buddha in Buddhism and so on. They, all these great minds were trying to say that if you provide the compunction that adds and brings things together, it has a power to do this. And if you do the opposite, to divide, to hate, to push things apart, then you go in the opposite direction. You become more atomic. You become more, if you like a robot. You become material and so forth. And I think that that's what is so amazing, that we have this capacity, if we choose, as Andrew said, in free will to do this, we can go back.
He was always very careful to point out that anything that he did, anyone else could do, even if someone was healed. He said, your faith has made you whole. And he quoted, of course, Psalm 82. He said, it's written, you are gods. He was saying that human beings are gods, that we're not just some pale reflection that has to idolize him and put him on a pedestal, that we can be exactly as he
was. We are the same. He was trying to say, you will do things that are even greater than I have done. Now, this is an amazing statement, and I think we all as human beings have to do this, shout this from the rooftops. You know, can I just sum this up simply in a sense, you know? If we live for a state of being beyond death, and not a state of being in life, so to speak, Jim, we might find the antidote for anything the greys or all these machine-type beings bring to bear on us. I believe the Shroud of Turin is the most powerful illustration paradigm, you know, to demonstrate the power over atoms of someone who lived for existence beyond the atomic state. That's the crucial thing. We have the capacity to exist beyond the atomic state in a coherent individuality we call ourselves, with all our prejudices hitched up in there. If we have less prejudices, we may live in a state of marvelous singularity forever and never come back into physical universes. But as long as we have these prejudices and all these kind of restrictions, we do drift back in more lifetimes and so forth, I believe, if you want to put a kind of, you know, board around it all. I'm sorry to rush like this with all these statements, but, you know, time is short, so you'll forgive me for going on like this.
No, not at all. I think it's a fascinating theory. I have to say, in 5 years of doing this program, a little over 5 years, that it's one of the most amazing theories that I've heard from standpoint of something you wouldn't necessarily expect, and the way that it ties many different elements together. So I applaud,
but if I could just
applaud the work.
Mention one thing also about there's an interesting story in the Bible that Jesus was taken to a high point by what was referred to as Satan, the devil, who interestingly, mythologically, is a creature who's supposed to have fallen from the sky. And he was taken to a place where he could see all the cities of the earth. Now, listeners can try a little experiment if they have a globe, and you can't do it with a flat map because of the distortion. And if you face it so that all the landmass is facing you. Interestingly, the middle of that landmass, you'll notice, is somewhere around Judea where Jesus was living. If you go up high enough into space, then you can see all of the landmass of the earth from one place, but only from space. So where, what is the devil and where did it take him?
And he said to this individual who said, I'll give you all of this, obviously this devil, this Satan, actually knew he possessed the earth to offer this to the Son of God, so to speak. Obviously, he thought he had some great power over him. And Jesus said to him in rebuke, get thee behind me, Satan. It is written, thou shalt not tempt the Son of Man. I think it was then that a robot was told what he really was, because a robot has no sense of identity. It's a program. And so this thing took that as information. And the great thing is that he returned him back to the earth. Now, if this robot was anything like a human being, we probably would have killed Jesus.
The good thing is about robots, they don't have egos.
Yes. So robots are just neutral beings, just absorbing information. If we can get these greys and shake these rascals and tell them what they truly are, then maybe they'll leave us alone. And maybe that's the best thing I can say about it.
No, absolutely fascinating work. It's been a fascinating hour that we've spent with Dr. Andrew Silverman and Nigel Kerner. Nigel's book is Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. We'll have links, Nigel, to your site and also to the book so folks can pick up on it. It's almost 500 pages and we've only scratched the surface. Gentlemen, thank you for being on the Paranormal Podcast.
Thank you very much, too, for your time and patience.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We will catch you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. So whatever time it is, when you're listening, morning, afternoon, evening, whatever it may be, we hope it's the best one ever. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com and thanks for listening.